From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're watching Wall Street, a significant rebound after yesterday's significant drop.
Maybe a sigh of relief, Robin. People often like to call the stock market a roller coaster, and this week it certainly has felt like one. Jason Bellini of the Wall Street Journal joins us from New York with the latest. And Jason, before the U.S. markets opened this morning, China cut interest rates, tried to flood the market with more cash. Tell us a little bit about what China did and what the thinking is behind that move.
That's right, Jeremy. First, I should point out that China's markets are down again, the free fall continuing, the Shanghai index down 7.6% lower again today. That means that they've lost in China about $1 trillion in equity value over just the past 4 days. And as you mentioned, China cut interest rates for the fifth time in 9 months. It's a new effort to shore up slowing growth in that country. And its central bank also increased the amount of money available for lending by cutting the bank's minimum reserve requirements. But again, the Shanghai composite fell 4 days in a row. But in Europe, stocks were up and U.S. stocks jumped here in the U.S. as well.
Well, I guess there's a real question in China and around the world about whether the moves that China is making to try and shore up confidence will work, because they've tried so many things now over the last several months and nothing seems to have worked.
Well, that's right. And they're really struggling to reassure investors that Beijing is prepared to take fresh measures to boost its economy. And this move comes after stocks around the world, as you mentioned, just have been tumbling everywhere. I mean, it's been a global problem. You know, remember, the Dow plunged more than 1,000 points at Monday's open. Economists are doubting that China grew at that 7% pace in the second quarter that the country's official statistics say. And, you know, they're looking at other types of data. Economists are looking at other types of data, such as power generation, passenger travel. And they think the rate may be as little as half of that. So really, what's China being sort of this black box where the politics are opaque, where the decisions are opaque. There are, you know, things have gotten better there, but that is contributing to the skittishness of investors globally.
Well, and we've been talking about what this means in China, the second largest economy in the world, and in the United States, the largest economy in the world. Of course, this is reverberating all over the world. And one of the places that people are looking now are the emerging markets, some of the, Brazils and Indias of the world that really do feel it when something like this happens in a country like China.
Oh, they're feeling it hard. They've been feeling it hard for a little while now. You know, if China stops importing raw materials for, you know, new bridges, factories, apartment buildings, that would really remove what has been one of the main drivers of growth in the world economy, and a world economy that has a few other bright spots. And this hits emerging economies particularly hard. They've really tied their destinies very closely to those of China. Russia, for example, you know, the Chinese woes have triggered that plunge in the price of rice in the ruble, as the price of Russia's principal export, oil, has really, really gone down. And that's had enormous economic consequences there. You know, Russia's the second largest supplier of oil to China after Saudi Arabia. And, you know, Southeast Asia, countries like Indonesia, it sells coal, minerals, palm oil to China. And its economy had been riding high, but now the stock market's down more than 20% in that country. Latin America, commodities, soybeans, copper, iron ore. During the past 15 years, China's been an amazing customer. But now Mexico, the peso's down 23% in the past year. Colombia is off an eye-popping 40%. And so far this year, Brazil's real has plunged nearly 36%. So definitely it's far, far away. But in a global economy, it's hitting very close to home for people in South America and all these other emerging economies.
Is there anything that they can do? Is there anything that a country that's so closely tied to China can do to try to right the ship?
Well, the standard solution would be to try to increase domestic demand, which is what China itself is trying to do, to get their consumers spending more. But that's a really challenging thing to do. It can't be done overnight when these countries have relied so heavily on China as to import their goods. So there really isn't a quick fix solution. They're really looking to China to try to turn this around, because they need to. The leadership there must turn this around, or they face real challenges disarray and of, you know, people in China turning against the government. And the other thing that's been happening in China is that you've had this major chemical explosion where there was very little information provided to the public. And so, you know, as a result, there's just so little confidence that, and that needs to be turned around, not just for the Chinese, but for people around, for economies around the world.
All right. Well, Jason, before I let you go, let me bring it back to the United States and just give me a one word answer here. But how would you describe the mood where you are on Wall Street today?
Well, you know, it's still quite skittish. There's enormous concern, but I think there's perspective that, you know, exports to China were 6.1% lower this year.
Right.
But, you know, that weakness appears to not have that as much of an impact because China only accounts for only about 1% of U.S. GDP.
Mm. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal. Jason, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if North Dakota's Bakken oil field were a stock, it would be up. Demand for electricity has also skyrocketed with the oil and gas boom, with the need for power, for machinery, and the homes of all the new oil workers. In the past, demand for more power in North Dakota might mean building a new coal-fired power plant. But that's become difficult in recent years, especially with new environmental regulations to cut carbon emissions. Emily Guerin of Here and Now contributor Inside Energy takes a look at how to meet a growing demand for power without coal.
Dale Haugen is really proud of his company's new garage.
You got to come and see the view. We're going to walk up the steps.
From a balcony, we peer out over the ground floor of the cavernous building that will hold equipment and trucks. It belongs to Montrail Williams Electric Cooperative, a North Dakota utility company that has recently seen explosive growth. Haugen's the general manager here.
This is my 33rd year.
And this utility is pretty much unrecognizable from when he started. It's gone from selling power to North Dakota farmers to selling almost exclusively to oil and gas companies.
Holy cow, what a change.
Montrail Williams sells 10 times as much power as it did 7 years ago. 10 times! That means over 100 new employees, new trucks, and a gigantic new garage. Sitting in Haugen's office, I asked him to explain how much electricity it takes to drill for oil.
So one oil well is equal to about 3.5 to 4 homes.
There's over 12,000 oil wells in North Dakota now. Plus you add pipelines, gas compressor stations.
Apartments, apartments, apartments.
Thousands of new oil field workers and their flat screen TVs. It adds up. Electricity use in North Dakota shot up 27% between 2008 and 2013, more than anywhere else in the country. And that power has to come from somewhere. Dale Haugen's utility distributes electricity, but it doesn't own the power plants themselves. These guys do.
John Jacobs, I'm the Vice President of Operations for Basin Electric.
Basin Electric Power Cooperative, based in Bismarck. It's a big utility with 3 million customers in 9 states, but it's got kind of a homey vibe. Like when you walk in, there's a display telling you what's for lunch. Today, it's tater tot hot dish, Midwestern for casserole.
You gotta not only feed your power plants, but you gotta feed your people.
Jacob says by 2035, the Bakken oilfield region will need 3 times as much power as it needs today. It's Basin Electric's job to figure out where that power comes from.
I don't know of any other utility that's dealing with these kinds of growth issues.
That's Jacob's colleague, Steve Tomac.
As we realized this growth was going to be huge, we developed a 3-prong approach.
1, buy power from utilities nearby that have extra. 2, get that power into the oil field with a new transmission line. And 3, build new power plants, ones that run on natural gas instead of coal. That's a big deal for Basin Electric because it has always used coal. There's tons of it in North Dakota, and it's cheap to mine. But a few years ago, that changed. Steve Tomac explains.
You know, in this environment, nobody will finance coal.
President Obama's rule to cut carbon dioxide emissions from power plants is called the Clean Power Plan. It was finalized earlier this month, but for years in advance, lenders told Basin Electric, hey, if you're planning on building new coal plants, we're not interested.
And it was very obvious that they didn't want to lend into that.
With regulations and market factors like low natural gas prices, the economics of coal just weren't adding up anymore. So Basin Electric began building wind farms and natural gas plants. And they had to do it fast, faster than they were comfortable with.
They thought I ought to go be pulled through a knothole on a wooden fence.
That was the reaction when Dale Haugen told Basin Electric just how soon he was going to need more power to meet oil field demand.
They were shocked.
In 7 years, Basin Electric has gone from shocked to making it work. With some growing pains, they figured out how to power the number two oil-producing state. As utilities around the country puzzle over how to provide more power, one industry analyst I talked to said he wouldn't be surprised if they call on Basin Electric to ask them how they did it so fast and how they did it without coal. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Guerin.
Before stock markets around the world plummeted, an airline industry group predicted that this Labor Day weekend could break records in the U.S. with 3% more people flying this year than last. And AAA said Labor Day weekend travel would be at the highest level since 2008. We'll see what happens when all is said and done. But one company with a front row seat to the travel industry is TripAdvisor. It calls itself the world's largest travel site with more than 250 million reviews and opinions of hotels, restaurants, and attractions all around the world. As part of our ongoing series of conversations with leaders called View from the Top, we're joined now by the co-founder, president, and CEO of TripAdvisor, Stephen Coffer. Welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, I want to start by asking you, as you watch what we're all watching, which is stocks around the world falling, what does that mean for a company like TripAdvisor?
Well, it is a bit turbulent, as they say in the travel industry out there at the moment, but it really doesn't mean much at all for TripAdvisor because we're a company that has always been focused on the long-term results. And the long-term results is that people will continue to travel, no matter whether the weather's a bit choppy at the moment or not.
So global stock downturn doesn't get people to stop traveling even in the interim?
It might have a temporary effect. It might not. But those temporary effects aren't what's guiding the future of TripAdvisor. When we look at the 370 million travelers that visit us each month, they're looking to have a great time. And so as they go about their business planning a trip, if a few less come this week and a few more come in a couple of months when turbulence might be over, it doesn't affect our long-term planning.
Well, let me ask you about another part of this, which is China. This is what's leading stocks down. And TripAdvisor recently sold off an entity in China. You said, quote, we're not winning in China. How difficult is that market?
China is an incredibly tough market in so many verticals, and certainly in the travel space where there are quite a few competitors and quite a few meaningful-sized internet companies with their own play in travel. So we look at the Chinese traveler looking to take a trip outside of their country, and we feel we have the best content, bar none, the best selection of hotels, restaurants, attractions. And so the asset or the company that we sold in China was one that focused on domestic travel, which isn't an area where we felt we had a leg up on anyone.
And what about the idea of Google and Amazon becoming bigger competitors of yours, getting into the online travel industry? Does that worry you?
Well, Google's been making little forays into travel for many, many years, but they haven't been able, at least in our estimation, to convince anyone that they're a great site to go to plan a trip. They're a very good search engine. And so our objection with Google is simply how they try to take some of the traffic that's coming to Google and sort of hide other results that are out there on the web, like a TripAdvisor, in order to preference their own offerings. In terms of Amazon, yes, they look like they're coming out with something or they have come out with something in travel. But again, a site that you go to buy stuff that is shipped to you, a book, an internet router, is a very different thing than helping someone plan a vacation.
But how do you get people to go to you to do the booking through TripAdvisor? Right now, you've got all the reviews. I might go to TripAdvisor and read reviews of hotels in Chicago, but then go and book them somewhere else, maybe even directly through the hotel's website. How do you get people to say, I'm going to do everything at TripAdvisor?
Well, that's the beauty of where we are positioned in the travel ecosystem. Folks that we run across, you know, just the average travelers, they love TripAdvisor. Why? Because we're providing that truly unbiased information on where to go, where to stay, and what to do. So they love these reviews, and they come to us and they say, help me, TripAdvisor, help me figure out where I'm going to stay. TripAdvisor offers the ton of selection, and then we offer the price comparison. So here's the price from Expedia, here's the price from Booking, here's the price from Orbitz, and here's a price from TripAdvisor. If TripAdvisor has a good price, then terrific. You, as a consumer, may be happy to book on TripAdvisor. If not, and you wish to book by clicking on the link to Expedia, that's fine with us. And when somebody else has a better price, we're transparent. We're showing you that better price and letting you click off to book on that site.
We've been talking about the traditional competition that you face from other websites that focus on hotels and things like that. What about Airbnb, which has really changed the game?
It has. They've carved out a bit of a new type of lodging category. It's both the shared space as well as, just frankly, a cheaper way to stay in a city, renting out someone's apartment. And it's a good service. I know TripAdvisor in our vacation rentals area, as well as other sites, offer very similar services in many different parts of the world. So all of the travel companies I'm aware of are clearly interested in helping the traveler find the place that they're looking for.
So you think you offer essentially the same thing as Airbnb if that's what the customer wants?
Correct.
Hmm. Have they made you do anything different because of their success?
No, I think they've opened up the category in terms of the short-term rental in a city that wasn't as strong as it was before. Vacation rentals and vacation rentals online had been around for a long, long time, but the notion of being able to rent an apartment in a city hadn't gotten particularly popular until more recently. And Airbnb deserves some credit for making that a compelling category and for being able to do so at a price point when other hotels, when the average daily rate for a hotel in a city is going up, up, up.
I want to ask you a question that I really could ask of any CEO, but I've got you here on the line, so I'm going to ask you, which is that you, like many, get a pretty big salary. We saw that you got a $38 million option award last year. You're not going to get one for another couple of years, but still, a lot of people look at that and say, that doesn't seem right, that the leader of this company is making so much more than the lowest paid employee. And I just wonder your thoughts on that.
Well, I guess when you look at kind of raw base, my salary is not particularly out of line with other CEOs. In fact, it's considerably lower. Not to say it isn't a wonderful salary to live on. The option grant, I think, is the right way to reward companies. If you look at my option grant to reward CEOs, if you look at my option grant, it's a 5-year grant. So it's the board of directors and myself aligned on building long-term value for the company where the benefit only accrues to me if, in fact, I grow the overall value of the company. And if it doesn't, then that option grant isn't worth $38 million. It's worth zero. And that's, I believe, a better way to compensate CEOs across the board.
So CEOs' pay should be tied to how the company is doing.
That's my belief.
All right. Well, Stephen Koffer, before I let you go, I just have a quick little lightning round for you, just a few short questions. Where do you like to travel?
Favorite destination is Jerusalem. Favorite recent destination would be Turkey.
Hmm. How many reviews have you written for your site over the years?
I think I'm up to about 100 now.
Wow. So you don't do it every time you travel?
Not every time.
How did you decide on the owl?
We were looking for a logo or a mascot, something better than just a typeface for our name. And when we thought about core attributes of TripAdvisor, we thought about, you know, a wise uncle or aunt who could advise us. We thought of something that could see in the dark to prevent those mysterious things happening on a trip. And I could go on and on, but you can see how an owl would become our mascot.
And who do you like for 2016?
I'd like the most honest politician out there. That would be my favorite.
Okay. Stephen Koffer, co-founder, CEO, and president of TripAdvisor. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And this note, today the Paris prosecutor's office formally opened a terror investigation into that thwarted train attack. The first passenger to wrestle with the alleged gunman, a French-American named Marc Mougallian, is recovering from his gunshot wound. The three Americans who came to his aid will be given a welcome home parade in Sacramento. Stay tuned for news on that. Meanwhile, yesterday we asked what makes people do such heroic things. Today, another example. Robert Ledoux. Sunday, he was out for a drive in rural Lake Charles, Louisiana, when he saw a police cruiser, lights flashing, a bloodied officer on the ground, and a man with a shotgun over him. Other motorists warned Ledoux to stay away. Instead, he tackled the armed man and handcuffed him. In a news conference yesterday, the head of the Louisiana State Police, Colonel Mike Edmondson, described what officers back at headquarters heard over the radio as Ledoux struggled.
You can hear him wrestling with him, and then he gets on the radio, and my troopers call, and you hear his voice saying, you got to get here. Get some help. We need some help. Your trooper's down.
An emotional Colonel Edmondson says Ledoux tried to help veteran trooper Stephen Vincent.
He rendered first aid. He rendered first aid for my trooper.
But Vincent died yesterday. The suspect, 54-year-old Kevin Daigle, has been charged with shooting the trooper when he came to his aid on the road. Trooper Vincent leaves behind a wife and a 9-year-old son. When his fellow officers described Robert Ledoux as a hero, he shook his head.
This year marks the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War, the anniversary of the end of slavery in the United States. The 13th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified in December of 1865. And with the abolition of one of the worst parts of our history came the end of one of the most uplifting, the Underground Railroad. From Here and Now contributor Michigan Radio, Lester Graham has the story of the role Detroit played in that amazing network.
We are stolen soul from Africa, transported to America.
Abolitionists used song and speeches to try to stop slavery in the U.S., but some also took action, smuggling runaway slaves out of the country. Some of the nation's leading abolitionists came to Detroit to debate their different approaches, including a famous meeting between Frederick Douglass and John Brown.
They met at the house of a third abolitionist, an African-American in Detroit named William Webb.
Ken Coleman is an author and historian.
So there is a history of Detroit proper being a sort of station, if you will, in the Underground Railroad.
Some historians say the fiery John Brown, who wanted to arm African Americans to begin an insurrection, didn't come to Detroit alone. It's said he brought a wagon load of escaped slaves to a church, a last stop before freedom.
At Second Baptist Church, the state's oldest African American church, there is a section of their tour where they actually show you where African American slaves would hide until they were able to make the journey to Canada.
Okay, now we're going to enter the original sanctuary.
Bobby Folks Davis is a church historian and tour guide at the Second Baptist Church of Detroit.
John Brown brought a wagon load through here because he was with the fellows that were going to meet at the Webb House.
Brown and Frederick Douglass did not agree on the use of violence. Just a short time later, Brown raided a federal armory to distribute weapons to slaves. He was captured and later executed. The congregation of the Second Baptist Church kept smuggling slaves out of the country. As we went into the basement of the church, Folks Davis explained the term Underground Railroad was code. Terms from the railroad described the system of escape.
A station is any place of hiding. This church was a station. The station master is anyone who has enough authority to let you hide. A conductor is the person who is going to lead the train. On the Underground Railroad, you are the train.
Folks Davis says the church elders felt it was their obligation not only to teach the gospel, but to teach African Americans to read, which was illegal in most of the nation, and to be part of the Underground Railroad.
To hide them, shelter them, and point them the way to freedom.
One of the prominent African Americans in Detroit at the time was George de Baptiste. He bought a steamship, which ferried people across the Detroit River, but it also smuggled many escaped slaves to Canada. While Michigan law was not always friendly to African Americans, there was an active abolitionist movement throughout the region. Ken Coleman says Detroit was a natural last stop.
It was where, you know, black people were. It's where more progressive thought was. And I think the proximity to freedom, being the width of the river, probably had a lot to do with that.
It's estimated that the Second Baptist Church of Detroit alone helped as many as 5,000 people cross the river to freedom. For Here and Now, I'm Lester Graham.
What if you were just diagnosed with terminal cancer, knew your time on Earth was nearing its end, and someone asked you what you'd like to accomplish before you die? Well, here's what former President Jimmy Carter said in response to that question last week.
As far as the Carter Center is concerned, I would like to see guinea worm completely eradicated before I die. I'd like for the last guinea worm to die before I do. I think right now we have 11 cases. We started out with 3.6 million cases.
Well, Jimmy Carter just might get his wish. Dr. Donald Hopkins is the Carter Center's vice president for health programs, at the forefront of the center's effort to eradicate guinea worm. He's also a former acting director of the CDC and credited with thinking outside the box in eradicating smallpox as well as fighting the guinea worm. So, Dr. Hopkins, what did you think when you heard your friend Jimmy Carter's answer?
Well, it was frankly not a surprise, because I know how eager he has been to see the end of this disease, as am I and Dr. Ruiz, the director of the guinea worm program at the Carter Center. So we're all wishing for it. And frankly, as soon as I heard the question being asked, I suspected that that was one of the things he might say.
Let's tell people what guinea worms are. It's uncomfortable to hear about, but horrific to have. You can pick up a guinea worm by drinking pond water. What happens?
People contract guinea worm disease by drinking water from open ponds, water that has been contaminated by previous victims of the disease. When a person manifests guinea worm disease, these 2 to 3 foot long, very narrow worms emerge through the skin on any part of the body, though usually on the foot, and the worm deposits hundreds of thousands of larvae into the water. The larvae in the water then are eaten by tiny water fleas that are barely visible to the naked eye. And if a person drinks water containing those infected water fleas, then the person will become infected. And without any symptoms in the interim, a year later, that person will begin to experience a burning sensation on some part of the body where the worm is getting ready to come out through the skin, and then the worm begins to emerge slowly.
Oh, it's burst through the skin, or comes out an eye socket. It's just really horrendous, and you can't just pull it out of your foot or your eye. You have to reel it out?
Correct. The treatment from time immemorial, ancient Egypt, has been to slowly wind the worm around a stick. Because if you break the worm, then those hundreds of thousands of larvae that would have been ejected into the water will spill into your tissues.
Right. And by the way, we speak of it going into the water because when this starts to happen, it's so painful and burning that the first instinct is to stick your foot in the water, where if the worm ejects there, it then deposits the larvae back in the water, and it just the cycle starts all over again. It's horrendous. No pill,
yes.
No vaccine. So how do you eradicate it?
Well, you can prevent this infection entirely. The key point about it is that it is only transmitted by people drinking contaminated water. And so the main interventions are health education, to teach people to not let anybody else with a guinea worm coming out of their body contaminate the drinking water in the first place, but also teach people, if they have to drink water from open ponds, to filter that water through a finely woven cloth always. In addition to that, there's a chemical that's donated by BASF Corporation that can be put in the water at 1 part per million that kills the larvae and with it the parasite, but doesn't harm plant life or or fish. The final way to intervene is to provide people with clean, safe drinking water in the first place, like from underground borehole wells. But as we've gotten closer to the end of this campaign, our surveillance has gotten tighter and tighter. And now all four of the countries that still have Guinea worm disease are offering a cash reward equivalent to about $100 for anybody who reports the case. That is a very important strategy adapted from the smallpox program that allows us to improve the surveillance. And we also have village volunteers in each of the villages at risk who are charged with talking with their neighbors, going around house to house, and making sure there are no undetected cases of Guinea worm disease. So we're increasingly comfortable that we know about all the cases.
You mentioned smallpox, and you were one of those who eradicated smallpox in Sierra Leone using a new strategy instead of trying to vaccinate the whole country. Teams would go to new outbreaks and vaccinate around them in widening circles, we understand. And when people were trying to talk about getting clean water to everyone, you said, well, how about just trying to eliminate the guinea worm by filtering existing water?
We have really focused on a village-by-village, person-by-person strategy because we have to change people's behavior. Unlike smallpox and other such campaigns, we don't have a vaccine that we can give people and then go away. Here we have to persuade people to keep themselves, if they have a worm coming out of their bodies, out of the water, keep their neighbors from going into the water with an emerging guinea worm, and then also to convince everybody in these at-risk areas to always use a cloth to filter their drinking water if they don't have other sources of safe drinking water.
How did you come to this? One of 10 children of Bahamian parents, you grew up in Miami, went to the prestigious Morehouse College, on to Chicago to study, University of Chicago. What happens? How do you get to guinea worm?
Well, in my case, I became aware of guinea worm disease during my sophomore biology class at Morehouse College when there was a picture, which was very dramatic of it, in the textbook that we were using. And then when I was between my junior and senior year, I got a scholarship to study in Europe, spent a vacation period down in Egypt while I was there, and saw people with what I now know as trachoma, but they were, to me, they were having a lot of flies and disease around their eyes. That made me want to study tropical diseases.
Well, there is a little bit of a stomach-turning factor to it. I mean, have you been there when you have you had to wind out a guinea worm around a twig, or?
Oh yes, I've seen many people by now, hundreds of people suffering from guinea worm disease, and it's something you never get used to. And as a pediatrician, I especially empathize with the children who were suffering because others in the health establishment, neighbors, sometimes parents, were not caring enough for them to help protect them from this terrible parasite.
Mm. Well, given that, I'm imagining you also want it to go before you do, as Jimmy Carter said.
Yes, I do want it to go, and not just for the satisfaction of me knowing that this disease is gone, but more for the health and well-being of people who are suffering from this parasite unnecessarily. We don't have a vaccine, and yet it's possible to get rid of it. And the longer the parasite lasts, the more the risk, obviously, of more people suffering. But also, rarely, about 0.5% of people who are affected by guinea worm disease in a given year will become permanently crippled, because if a worm comes out next to your knee or ankle or elbow or wrist, it can cause enough damage there that that joint becomes permanently frozen. And so that if that's your knee, for example, the muscles in the lower part of the leg will shrivel up exactly as if you had had polio there. And so it's a terrible infection. And the longer it lasts, greater the chance for an increase in the number of people who are permanently crippled, even though the acute suffering from the disease is time-limited.
Mm. Well, Dr. Hopkins, we hope with your good work and the work from the Carter Center, that worm's going down. only a few cases left. Although, you know, there's sort of a tongue-in-cheek Save the Guinea Worm website because the thinking is that it is going down. And so they're asking for volunteers to be hosts for the last
yes.
few worms.
Yes. I don't know whether that's serious or not, but
I think it's completely tongue in cheek.
Well, I'm so worried on behalf of the people suffering from this parasite, but I'm confident that anybody who might be inclined to volunteer would withdraw that consent once they saw anybody else with one of these worms coming out of their body.
Yeah, continue your good work. Thank you so much, Dr. Donald Hopkins, again of the Carter Center's effort to eradicate guinea worm. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you.
Today is the 99th birthday of our national parks. On this day in August 1916, President Woodrow Wilson signed an act creating the agency, placing 35 parks, including the still famous Yellowstone, under its control. To celebrate today's national park birthday, admission is free at all 408 national parks today. But getting new visitors, especially young people, to the country's national parks continues to be a challenge. That's something we heard about in April when I spoke with Interior Secretary Sally Jewell. I caught up with her at a kiosk in front of the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C. Jewell had kiosks installed so that visitors at different park sites could talk to each other. Sally Jewell stepped up to the kiosk to talk to kids visiting the Martin Luther King Jr. National Historic Site in Atlanta.
Hi there. Who am I saying hi to?
Sierra.
Sierra and what?
Nanai.
Nanai. Are you coming to visit the park?
Yes, we came all the way from Connecticut.
Wow, from Connecticut.
The connection isn't great, but Jewel says the kiosks are crucial to getting young people interested in visiting the national parks.
What this is all about is using technology not to disconnect people from nature, but to connect them. So a little hard to hear the audio on that, but as we perfect technology, it's going to give us a chance to give people an experience perhaps with parks that they haven't seen before and maybe inspire them to get off the couch and out of in front of the screen and come out and visit.
Show them the parks that they don't know about or that they might visit in the future.
Inspire them to visit parks in the future. It's 407 units of the National Park Service, and people might think of the iconic national parks like the Grand Canyon or Yellowstone. But they don't realize that there's a national park that commemorates the life and the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, there's a national park right here, the National Mall, which is the nation's front yard, which really invites people to learn about our history and our culture. And of those 407 units, they tell all kinds of stories, and we want people to know about them.
So people are going to hear you say that and wonder, are people not going to the parks? Is there a problem? What's going on? Why do they need to educate everyone about the parks?
Well, there's no question we have great levels of visitation to the national parks, and we hit records in 2014. But when you look at our visitors, they aren't representative of the whole population of the U.S. We're underrepresented with minorities in our parks. They tend to be older visitors and not younger visitors, and younger visitors are really tied into technology, and using that technology to connect them to parks is a way where we hope to drive visitation that's more reflective of the American population.
Why do you think that is, that younger people aren't going to the parks as much?
Well, we're urbanizing as a population, and young people are really busy. Most of the time, they're spending time during their day being told what to do by an adult. In school, on a soccer field or a basketball court someplace, or maybe in a karate class or ballet classes, they are being given very little time to get outside and explore on their own. And so for many of them, by their parents' busy schedules and their busy schedules, they're just getting more and more disconnected from public lands and open spaces and parks and nature. And we want to be part of the solution to turn that around.
What do you say to people who don't like any technology in the parks? They're not going to be happy with this. They weren't happy when you put more cell towers in some of the national parks.
I would say that they make assumptions about how people are using technology that may not be accurate and up with the times. I have children, they've been digital natives themselves, and I FaceTime with my new little grandson, and it's an opportunity to use technology to keep us connected as human beings. And so if you allow people to use their technology, something that they're really comfortable with, we think that it will engage them more in the space as opposed to disconnect them. I will tell you, I've heard many park rangers talk of the stories of having kids that are zoomed into their technology on a video game, and then pretty soon, the deeper they get into a park or the deeper they get on a paddling trip, the more they look up and realize what's going on around them, and then they use their devices for different purposes, like taking pictures and sending them to their friends on Snapchat or, you know, whatever they're using. So we want to embrace it.
Why do you have a problem bringing more minorities, as you say, into the national parks?
Well, I would say here in Washington, D.C., among the cherry blossoms, we welcome a broad diversity that's probably pretty reflective of the population of Washington, D.C. and the city broadly. But when you get to more remote national parks, many families have not had a tradition of going out taking long family vacations. They may live in urban areas. It's not been just part of how they've chosen to recreate. And yet, as we urbanize as a population and as we become more diverse, we will need advocates in the future. They will be sitting in the halls of Congress. They'll be on county councils and city councils and state legislatures, and they will be reflective of the population. So we need to make sure that our parks are relevant and welcoming and accessible to all Americans. And while maybe in Anacostia Park in Washington, D.C., and on the National Mall, we have broad diversity, that's not true across the country, and we believe we have some work to do to make sure that people recognize these are their parks.
Part of our conversation with Interior Secretary Sally Jewell in front of the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C. this past April. Again, Robin, today is the 99th birthday of our national park, so they are free to get into today. Do you have a favorite?
Oh, too many. Bryce, Zion, Chickamauga.
Grand Canyon.
Chattanooga.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder if people do all of them. You know, do a trip and try to hit them all.
What are we doing inside?
I know.
Robin?
Let's go.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.